Welcome to the Unconventional Dyad Podcast, where psychology and psychoanalysis meet social justice, feminism, politics, climate change, critical theory, graduate student mental health, and the arts.
Your hosts are Carly and Laura, two graduate students and friends committed to bridging the gap between the field of psychology, social issues, and society.
Thank you for joining us.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Unconventional Dyad Podcast. Today, we speak with Dr. Elizabeth Paquette, who is an assistant professor of philosophy and women's and gender studies at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. She works at the intersection of social and political philosophy, feminist philosophy, and decolonial theory. Her book, titled Universal Emancipation, Race Beyond Badou, engages French political theorist Alain Badiou's discussion of negritude and the Haitian Revolution to develop a nuanced critique of his theory of emancipation. Currently, she is working on a monograph on the writings of decolonial theorist Sylvia Winter.
Today, we discuss engaging in decolonial texts and Dr. Paquette's process of finding and engaging with these texts. We also discuss Dr. Paquette's feminist decolonial workshop she created a few years ago to start to better understand the intersection between feminism and decolonialism. Lastly, we discuss Dr. Paquette's book, Universal Emancipation, Race Beyond Badou, and her upcoming book on Sylvia Winter. We hope you enjoyed the episode.
Dr. Paquette, welcome to the podcast. We're really excited to have you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Before we get started, do you want to introduce yourself to our listeners?
Yeah, so my name's Dr. Paquette, Dr. Elizabeth Paquette. My pronouns are she and her, hers. I am an assistant professor of philosophy and women's gender studies at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. Charlotte is located on the traditional territories of the Catawba, Shara, Waxhaw, and Chicoree peoples. I've been in Charlotte since 2015, and I've been permanent faculty since 2017 in Charlotte, and I am also I'm also affiliate faculty with Africana Studies and the Holocaust, Genocide, and Human Rights Studies.
There's a lot of overlap there between different programs. That's something that I noticed right away when you started talking. Can you share a little bit about how you divide your time up between those different programs?
Yeah, well, so contractually, I mean, there's a contractual aspect of it, right? So women gender studies is where I spent 80% of my time, and then my tenure home was in philosophy. And so that in a lot of ways has been really a really fruitful place for me to be, because in women gender studies, I get to teach a lot of the things that I really enjoy. And so while my philosophy department is not constraining in any sense, you know, I get to engage with feminist theory, queer theory, critical race theory. And so I get to teach a lot of these really fun topics courses that also become really cornerstone courses for the program as well. Mm-hmm. And then with that, you know, I teach Indigenous feminisms, and that gets taken up in the Holocaust, Genocide, and Human Rights program. And then I teach critical race theory, and that gets taken up in Africana Studies. And so, like, it's been I was nervous at the beginning of what it would mean being trained in philosophy and moving into women gender studies. But it has been a really wonderful place to work and a really fruitful, and the students are wonderful too. And so we have lots of great conversations, both with women gender studies and philosophy as well.
Can you talk a little bit about your journey into philosophy? Where did you start?
So in my undergrad, I was actually a biology major. I wanted to be an epidemiologist. And so I think I saw the movie Outbreak when I was a kid, and I wanted to be like the people in Outbreak. And so I spent maybe 3 years doing biology. And the place where I did my undergrad, you need to take like these year-long courses. You take a year-long chemistry, year-long biology. And so I did those, and then I had space left over, so I took the intro to philosophy course. And I really liked it. And every year I would take a couple more philosophy classes. And then finally I realized that I clicked with philosophy in a way that I didn't click with biology. And that's in part by having, you know, I had wonderful teachers in philosophy, people who continue to mentor me even today. And so that was, I started in 2001. So people have been part of my life now for, you know, 20 years. So that propelled me, right? So then I did my undergrad at Trent University, which is in a small town in Peterborough. I did my master's at the University of Guelph, which is in Ontario as well. And then I did my PhD at York University, which is in Toronto in Canada. So all my studies are in the Ontario Canadian education system. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I learned a lot at each institution. Each institution had its own, you know, strong qualities that moved me forward in various ways, which I'm very grateful for.
Such an interesting story. I also started in biology. So I did my undergrad in biology, I got a master's in biology, and then I was doing a PhD in biology as well. And I went from that to psychology and to psychoanalysis. So we had a very interesting trajectory there. And I also found myself more at home in the philosophy department, even in undergrad and religious studies. And so I find that, you know, people who can relate to that, I don't know, I just think that's such an interesting change in careers. And I also get that from other people too. Like, how did you end up in psychology and psychoanalysis?
Yeah. And it's funny. I mean, like biology, entering in biology, I mean, it means you have a certain kind of interest in the world, right? So you want to know how cells work. You want to know what the kind of the base structure for the world and plants and the air we breathe and all these things around us. And for me, it was like how it is that, you know, viruses, you know, infiltrate cells and what that looks like and what that means. And so, I mean, there's a lot of fundamental questions that go into that as well, right? Like meanings of existence, like building blocks of existence. And so it just depends on what kinds of questions you're asking. And so, you know, I think from high school, a lot of us, we move to biology because we take classes in biology in high school and it piques a certain kind of interest in certain kinds of questions. But for me, it was, you know, it was philosophy of science that really turned for me, that I realized that, you know, I can engage with the questions I had in biology. And I can just do it through philosophy in a way that, you know, suits me a lot better rather than labs. And, you know, I was never very good at labs, which is the other side of it. But yeah.
So interesting. So let's pivot a little bit and talk a little bit about your interest in decolonial texts and how you arrived there.
Yeah. I was thinking about how it got started because when I did my undergrad and master's and PhD, we didn't read decolonial texts. We didn't read critical race theory. We read feminist theory, but the feminist theory was very much constrained to white feminist theory. So it took me a while to get to the point of engaging with decolonial texts, and it was a lecture that I went to in 2014. It was the Diverse Lineages of Existentialism. So I had studied existentialism before. So Simone de Beauvoir was my favorite philosopher, and I read, you know, Heidegger and Merleau-Ponty. And I know there's some overlap, at least with psychology or psychoanalysis there for sure. And I heard a talk by Paget Henry on Sylvia Winter. And it was a paper on Sylvia Winter and Simone de Beauvoir. But hearing Dr. Paget Henry talk about Sylvia Winter, you know, I was flabbergasted. I was amazed. You know, I was like, I need to start reading this figure. And so I started reading her figure. And the more I got into it, the more I realized, you know, there's other texts that I need to read in order to make sense of what Sylvia Winter is talking about. And that led me on a progression of engaging with decolonial theory or critical race theory, Caribbean theory, in a multitude of ways. And it's something that I'm still working on. I think that, you know, because my education was very much focused on a particular area of research, very much in philosophy. Philosophy is very dominated by white male philosophers in particular. And so it gave me an opportunity to engage in things that were different than that, but also required that I put a lot of work into it and do a lot of those studies on my own. So I mean that was like the moment that I think back of, like, here's someone that I need to start reading and need to understand what it is that she's talking about. The other thing is that, you know, in reading like Marxism in reading, you know, these various, you know, theories of liberation or freedom, like I was always really excited about political philosophy and what that meant for, you know, freedoms and people and, you know, how this impacts lived realities. But with Marxism, like I always felt that there was something missing, right? And so I would ask professors, like, how does feminist theory fit into this? I often didn't get a very good answer for it. And so the more I sort of looked into what was missing in those theories, the more I found people who were writing about Marxism, right? So C.L.R. James is writing about Marxism, critiquing Marxism. Aimé Césaire, who's Martinican, was critiquing Marxism and had been doing so for a very long time. And so that's my interest in Marxism, my interest in philosophy and political philosophy provided the conditions to make this sort of move into engaging with these figures who have been working on the things that I was already interested in and gave me a new lens and a new framework to start thinking about it.
You mentioned that you had to do a lot of this work outside mm-hmm. of your own academic institution or outside of your coursework. Can you speak to the struggle there, finding these texts, finding people to connect with and talk about the texts? What was that like for you?
It was difficult, you know, and so in the places that I was studying, there's often people weren't working on it. In philosophy in particular, it was hard to find people who were working on it. So sometimes it meant, you know, finding folks who were in other departments or fields that I could do that kind of work with. And so, you know, English literature, literature departments, sociology, you know, as you know, a bunch of other people in the humanities in particular, you know, that I would start meeting. It also meant finding conferences that were doing this kind of work. And so I was lucky with the diverse lineages of existentialism. I mean, I was there to present a paper on Beauvoir. And so that was, you know, that was a great opportunity. And they had done that work to bring folks together. And that allowed me to meet, you know, more people. But a lot of it was making those personal connections at conferences and finding out, like, who are the people who are studying, you know, critical race theory, decolonial theory, where are they going? What journals are they publishing in? Because a lot of the field of philosophy that I was made aware of in a certain sense was doing particular kinds of things. And so getting outside of that required a whole new training of, like, where this is located, what journals, who the key figures in it, because often the key figures are, you know, they're spread out across the country. It's not like one department where people are really, really doing this. You know, so it took a lot of work. And I think it still takes a lot of work. I think it's still something that, you know, requires community and it requires the intentional building of community, which is often not easy. But when you get those communities, it's all the more worthwhile for sure.
Yeah. We're getting to the workshop faster than I had anticipated. Oh. I think it's really it's great. I think we need to talk about that. We can come back to some of the ideas that I wanted to ask you about, but let's talk about the workshop. This is a perfect place to talk about it. The sense of community and the sense of building these connections. Can you share what workshop you've developed?
Yeah, so it's called the Feminist Decolonial Politics Workshop. You can find it online. It'll be the first thing that pops up if you type those words in. And for me, it arose out of trying to find community, and specifically on trying to find community where I could talk about Sylvia Winter with folks, right? And so I had this experience in 2014. So I started trying to read Sylvia Winter. And Sylvia Winter is an amazing theorist. She draws from, you know, psychology, psychoanalysis, philosophy, geography, history, literary theory, and she weaves all these different disciplines together in one essay, which means that her essays are particularly difficult to get through and understand because it requires all these different areas of expertise to actually get engaged with them. And her essays are, you know, average, you know, 90 pages or so. In philosophy, our essays are not usually that long. And so this was, it was a considerable task to sort of work through her corpus. So I started talking to folks about it. And I said, like, does anyone want to read Sylvia Winter? There's more and more people who are reading her work. You know, people are very similar positions as me, where, you know, there's no one teaching it, or very few people teaching it, certainly at the institutions that we were at, and how to sort of engage in those conversations. So I put together like a bunch of people. We all agreed to it. I emailed like a month or two later. All of a sudden, no one can do it. So I was like, okay, like this, like, and I was very intent on doing it that summer. And so by happenstance, you know, I was living in Canada at the time, and I knew, and my partner knew a confluence of people in Montreal. So out of these people in Montreal and a few other folks, we all went to Montreal, and we spent about, I remember it was 4 or 5 days talking about our work. And it was a rejuvenating experience. It was wonderful. I mean, it's really hard to describe because it was, you know, there was 8 of us or so, and we just sort of met every day, and we just hashed through, you know, each article, and everyone was responsible for presenting one article, and we just sort of worked through it. And then we used our various areas of expertise to offer different perspectives on it at the same time. And so it was really constructive, and it was really, I don't even know what the right word is. Like it rejuvenated, I think, a lot of us in thinking about that work and ways that we could engage with it. So I wanted to continue that work, right? And so, I mean, the goal of the workshop is to avoid, you know, tokenizing figures. And so instead of having a workshop, you know, where we read 8 different figures and we just sort of read one article from each person, the point of it is to really get an idea of the entire corpus or as much as possible of a particular figure. So every summer since then, you know, there's been one figure that we've read, you know, a couple books at least, or several books, sometimes 3 books, depending on the length of them, and then several articles. And so we can understand the various moves that are being made across time. And again, like it brings people in from a variety of disciplines every year, which I'm very grateful for. We do it during the summer now. And so people come together for four or five days. They're full days. And we're just working through one particular figure each time. So we've read the works of Dr. Audrey Simpson, Trinity Minha. I can't even remember who else right now. But every year we pick someone who we were interested in engaging with. The nice thing about it, too, is that, you know, it's very much democratically run, or as much as possible. And so every year, every participant who's ever participated in the workshop gets to suggest figures for the next year, and then we vote on them. And so whichever figure has the most votes is a figure that we'll read the next year. And so every year it's growing more and more each year. And it gets people, you know, from across the United States. It's now there's people coming from you know, outside the United States as well. And it's been this great opportunity to engage with decolonial feminist theorists. On top of, like, you know, providing the context for, you know, understanding someone's entire corpus, it also has given the opportunity to, you know, provide ways of entry into teaching this. And so, you know, in an attempt to sort of move philosophy in different directions, and this goes for other disciplines as well, how is it that we can incorporate this into our teaching? Then the other thing it does is it builds community, because again, like, we're bringing in students from across the United States, from outside the United States, and often these students are finding that they are in departments where they aren't getting a lot of support, that they're not reading the figures that they feel most compelled by, they just aren't reading decolonial figures at all. And then so it provides networks outside of that as well, which has been really helpful. And it's for graduate students, but it's also for junior faculty, and then some senior faculty have participated in it as well.
After you meet, do you do any writing together? Do you stay connected throughout the year after you guys meet?
So we've tried that a little bit, and I think it's done informally, but there hasn't been anything formally part of that structure yet. But I think it's a great idea, and I think that, like, you know, I think there are, like, people become friends at the workshop. You know, it's 5 days of very intensive time together where, you know, everyone eats lunch together more or less, and we don't, like, people are often staying in the same places or they're billeted with other folks. And so informally as part of the structure that does happen, but we haven't done that writing together yet. But I think that raises a good point of, you know, maintaining those connections outside of that 1 week every year kind of thing.
Yeah, I'm thinking a little bit about something similar is happening within psychology and psychoanalysis. I don't think to the extent of that, but we're really starting to talk about a social psychoanalysis. And what I was wishing for early on in my psychology career was a place like you were talking about, a place where you can go, where you can discuss, where you can stay connected throughout the year. And that is just the coolest idea. I absolutely love that idea. And I wish I had something like that in psychology that I can do. There are some things here and there that you can get involved in. But for the most part, you really have to try hard to stay connected and put in the effort to stay connected.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, like, with that, like, I want to encourage, you know, everyone else, you know, this thing, when I started it, it doesn't require any funds. It requires a little bit of organizing. And, you know, this year, we canceled last year because of the pandemic, but this upcoming year, we're going to be online, which also, you know, that changes the way that we can access it, you know, so there's less flights from other places or less travel from other places, which makes it more affordable in a lot of ways, although there's other kind of concerns that arise out of it, for sure. But, you know, I think that I would encourage, you know, everyone to start one. And just, I mean, you can start it, you know, locally and start small and start it with, you know, five people. And it's, I think it's well worth it. And it's well worth it part of the structure that it kind of provides us with. And then, you know, it can grow in any number of ways from there as well.
I'm curious. I want to go back to what we were talking about at the very beginning, this kind of struggle that you had finding text to read, having to go outside of the institution. I feel something very similar in psychology. I feel like I have to go outside of the institution to find text that I find interesting. And I'm wondering, coming from a faculty perspective, I'm wondering what are some things that students can do to start integrating some of those texts within their classroom, whether that's, you know, pushing the curriculum committee, whether it's talking to, you know, administration. What would you recommend if students really wanted to push a little bit more?
You know, that's a great question. I think that question is often seldom asked and is really important. Because I think that, you know, this is it's all of our responsibilities, you know, as faculty. I've been faculty for you know, 3 years now. And so like, I recognize a different kind of burden that comes from structuring classes and what I incorporate in my classes and how that'll impact students and what students need in those spaces. And so I think that, you know, suggesting at the departmental level and saying, like, these are the kinds of concerns that we have. How is it that that decolonial theory or critical race theory can be incorporated into courses writ large, you know, across the department? The difficulty sometimes is, you know, you can't often just insert it into a classroom, right? And that becomes the part of about tokenizing, right? So if it's a matter of, like, here is, you know, major theory X, and then the last week is, like, you know, a person of color, right? Since that becomes really problematic. And so there's a need also to sort of make sure that the person who is doing it is including it well, and is doing the work, I think, in good faith as well. So with that, you know, I think that also having students being part of hiring, right? So when hiring happens, who is it that's being hired and what is that person's specialty? And how is it that the new hire can hope to change the structure of the department, or what are concerns that students are having in the department such that a new hire can change it? But that also comes with the problem of, like, we don't want, you know, for instance, like, a person of color to be tokenized in any particular department. And so institutions now are using cluster hires often to bring in cohorts of POC faculty, which is a great strategy. And so I think, you know, being attentive to it on all those layers is really important. And so one, like, telling the department or telling professors, what is it that you all are interested in? Sometimes that means, you know, pushing them to do the work themselves. Sometimes it means, you know, often, you know, we'll hear, you know, oh, no one's doing that work. No one's doing, you know, decolonial psychoanalysis or decolonial psychology, which is false, right? I mean, yep. It's inherently false. And so sometimes it means, you know, building a reading list. And I think that, you know, we have to do that for ourselves a lot of the times. Like when institutions aren't providing the things that we want, how is it that we can create those lists ourselves and start working on them? But often, unfortunately, it's important to have like something in one's back pocket, you know, for when this move happens where no one's working on this, you know, you can submit a list of like, here are all the people who are working on this. And this is why this work is really important. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the difficulty because, you know, the institution is kind of a wily thing that, you know, you have to get new hires, you have to get cluster hires. And a lot of that is out of, you know, students' control. But I will say that students have a lot of power in the university. Like while students may stay, you know, for 4 years for undergrad or for longer for doctoral programs, that students are stakeholders in the university. And so, you know, if a survey comes out that says like 80% of the students want, you know, classes that engage with decolonial theory, that has power for the institution and for the department as well.
A while back, I was talking to my school's president about the curriculum, and one of her biggest concerns, and I don't know much about curriculum development. That is certainly not something that I am too up on. I will say, however, that one of her concerns was the accrediting body, so the institution within the umbrella of the accrediting body. And I'm kind of curious if you have any thoughts about ways to start challenging that, even maybe not even within the institution itself, but within the accrediting body who kind of governs the institutions within it.
So I think that goes back to, you know, to pointing to experts in the field that already exist and are already doing that work, because it sort of what I read into that comment. And so correct me if I'm wrong about this, because I may be mistaken, but it seems as though the concern is that you know, that decolonial theory or decolonial psychology doesn't count as psychology, right? And so that's a really problematic framing for it. And the presumption that there aren't people doing that work already is false. And they haven't been doing that work for a long time, right? So Frantz Fanon was a psychologist who was also, you know, an activist and a revolutionary, right? And so, and there are people writing about Fanon not only in philosophy, but also in psychology, I'm sure. And so turning to that, the history and the body of knowledge that already exists as something to point to, because the presumption in that instance is that like that body of knowledge doesn't exist. And I think that, you know, what I learned in studying folks in decolonial theory, in critical race theory, and also indigenous studies, what counts as knowledge is inherently produced by certain kinds of structures, right? So white supremacy is going to be one of those structures that determines what counts as knowledge. And in academia, there's this very similar conversation of what counts as knowledge, what can and ought to be accredited, and what ought not be accredited. I mean, so there's... That's one, that's problematic. And then two, you know, turning to systems that already exist and using that to further one's argument in those instances can be really helpful. And hopefully too, I mean, hopefully there's, you know, faculty that one can get on one side or faculty in other programs that can be helpful in supporting, you know, those questions.
Great, thank you for going there with me. I don't oftentimes get a chance to really talk about curriculum development necessarily. I think people either are just not quite comfortable with it or just aren't quite knowledgeable enough about it to have, you know, to be able to have a conversation. So I really appreciate you going there with me and talking about that.
I also have to say it's great that you're meeting with the president about this, the president of the university. You know, I think that, you know, isn't an easy task to do given, you know, relations of power within those contexts. And so that's wonderful that you're having those conversations at, you know, a multitude of levels, for sure.
I would love to talk a little bit about your book and pivot one more time to talk a little bit about your book. It was published in 2020, correct?
Yes. Yeah. It came out in October 2020.
Perfect. Yeah. All right. So it is called Universal Emancipation, Race Beyond Badu. So tell us a little bit about the book. I haven't read it yet, but I am really excited to get my hands on it.
Yeah. Yeah. So it is a labor of love in a lot of ways. It is a book that came out of my own seeking to understand, you know, a certain trajectory of political theory. As I mentioned previously, you know, my training in philosophy is very, I sort of tracked from my undergrad right to grad school. And so I read a lot of Marx, I read a lot of Hegel, and then I've read a lot of figures that fall into sort of a French Marxist tradition, you know, all the way from Althusser to Balibar, then to Badiou. And so I've been reading these figures for a long time and engaged in their work, trying to understand them. And so I read Badiou, and I find Badiou is a very, difficult, figure to work through. It required engaging with set theory, which is a form of mathematics that I don't do set theory largely. And I did it primarily to understand his works. He's a big system thinker, right? And so he has these large texts that are very complicated. And so I spent a lot of time sort of working through them. And then I reached the point of, you know, I have a sense of it, but something doesn't seem quite right about it. And so I was trying to figure out, like, what's missing, or you know, how does this apply in other contexts? What can we do with this? What does this look like for real life relations and theories of liberation, right? Because it's about emancipation, it's about freedom, and what's possible within that. And so he very much has this Marxist framing. And so he thinks that, you know, a theory of liberation is, it comes out of a big event. And so we can think of various revolutions that led to the overturning of the state and the creation of something new that came out of it. You know, not unlike Marxism, which is about, you know, doing away with the bourgeoisie, and once the bourgeoisie, there'll be no more proletariat, and then we'll have equality, that kind of transition through Marxist structures. So I started to read, you know, Sylvia Winter, and I started to read other folks, and I was trying to figure out, well, what is it that's happening in Sylvia Winter's work that's not happening in Badiou's work, or how is it that they're different from each other? Because both of them are talking about a kind of universality, right? And so often we think about universality as either, you know, really important because it means everyone has, you know, the same, or it's problematic because it removes all differences. But Sylvia Winter's still talking about universality. So I was trying to figure out what happened there. And so I did a lot of the writing of the book, and I moved through various sections of that I thought would work in one way or another. And then I found out about this debate between Jean-Paul Sartre and Frantz Fanon. And the debate was between Jean-Paul Sartre wrote Black Orpheus, and Jean-Paul Sartre's Black Skin, White Masks, and one of the chapters in it. And so Fanon is directly responding to Sartre. And so in reading, one, what Sartre was writing, I saw a significant overlap between Sartre's argument about Marxism, essentially, and Badiou. And so for Sartre in particular, you know, he's trying to sort of think about, you know, what's the relationship between class and race? In thinking about theories of emancipation, what's the relationship between them? How are they different from each other? And he does this thing where he says that, you know, race is, you know, a step along the way to universality that we get to through class. And so he places class and race in a hierarchical relationship, whereas race is something that one has to get over to join the class movement, and then we can have universal emancipation. And so part of this is thinking about how it is that Black identified folks may join the class revolution, essentially, and that Black consciousness is really important, but it's only important to the point of getting to become part of this class, class consciousness and then class revolution. And so Fanon critiques that. And so there are various scholars who are working on Fanon and how he thinks about the negritude movement. But that one thing he says is that the assumption that that class is this thing that we get over, sorry, that race is this thing that we get over before we get to class, is a problematic hierarchy. And essentially what it does is it assumes that class is more important than race. That race is just something that we get over before we can have this kind of class consciousness, which is universal, in a way that race isn't. And so the move that Sartre was making, where he prioritizes class over race, is the same move that Badiou is making in his political theory writ large. And he, you know, he quotes Sartre. He uses the same points as Sartre. And so the connection between them, you know, it just fit all of a sudden. And so already what I realized is already in critical race theory, already in decolonial theory, there are already the arguments available to critique the thing that Badiou is doing. But the problem, and this is part of, I think, the problem of, you know, how it is that knowledge is structured and what counts as knowledge and whose knowledge is most important. It doesn't ever seem as though Badiou has read these figures or that he takes seriously the critiques that they're putting forward. Right. And so Badiou's still alive today. And so, you know, Fanon studied in France, you know, he studied in Paris, he studied under Merleau-Ponty. He is widely published, you know, these books aren't hiding. He makes a reference to Black Skin, White Mass at some point in time in one of his books without actually engaging with it fully. But he doesn't actually engage in the problem at hand. And so in a certain sense, what I do in this book is I make evident those overlaps and that the critiques that Fanon offered are still applicable to what Badiou is talking about today. And they're still really important because, you know, Badiou is still writing and publishing and people are engaging with this without thinking about, again, Fanon's critique of Sartre and then also how it is that it applies to Badiou's work. So that's sort of the first part of the book. The second part of the book is thinking about how it is that Badiou scholars frame the Haitian Revolution. And so I started reading a couple of figures who use Badiou's theory to talk about the Haitian Revolution. And the way that they engage with it is they draw it into a kind of universality where it's like the French Revolution. So they say, you know, just like the French Revolution, the Haitian Revolution is about liberty for all. But if you go to people who are writing about the Haitian Revolution without Badiou, and if you go to the documents about the Haitian Revolution, what you find is there's a very different story happening there, right? And it's a complicated story, and I don't want to say that, you know, it's either one thing or the other. There are aspects of the French Revolution. The statements following the French Revolution that were taken up as part of the Haitian Revolution. But there's various kinds of moments that happen. And so one moment that happens in the Haitian Revolution in one of the articles the statement of freedom that comes out of it is that, you know, all citizens in Haiti are Black. And so there's a moment when, you know, emancipation or freedom comes through, you know, a conception of race, right? And so that's different than how Badiou was talking about it, where he says that class is the most important thing, and class is the thing that's universal, and race is just something that you move through. But it actually becomes central to it. And so ignoring that or forgetting it, it seems really problematic. You know, how is it that we can say that the Haitian Revolution doesn't involve race in a central way, since it is, you know, it was an emancipatory movement to end slavery, you know, for Black people in Haiti. And so again, like, that was another point of, you know, can we think about how Badiou's theory fits in these different contexts? And what it does sometimes is it provides a sort of a narrowing of how we understand the histories of, for instance, the Haitian Revolution, along terms that are more consistent with a theory about class, and then by extension, often a theory about whiteness to the exclusion of race, because it seeks to exclude race as being something that can be fundamental for emancipatory movements. And so those are the two big problem cases that I think about with Bedu, how he might respond to Fanon, which I don't think he does very well, and then how a Bedu scholar would engage with the Haitian Revolution. And again, I think it's limited in these ways. The last sort of move, and this is the last chapter, is my chapter in Sylvia Winter, who I'll keep coming back to. And she engages with thinking about emancipation as well, and how we think about freedom. But when she talks about universality, she doesn't say that we have to sort of delimit it to class or this one thing that applies to all people, which in many ways gets coded as whiteness. And she says, you know, instead, emancipation has to be filled with particularity. And there's something really striking about that for me. You know, what does it mean, you know, not to have, you know, either particularity or universality, but that we can think about liberation movements that are, you know, they don't require that everyone's the same. They don't require that everyone has the same desires or goal or endpoint. And that thinking about liberation is more complicated than that. And so, you know, the way my work is moving forward after this is to think about, you know, what does that mean and what does that look like within her work sort of more broadly. So I end sort of with this question like, oh, it can look this way. There's a number of scholars who talk about the role of particularity for universality. And so there are other systems out there to engage rather than Bedu's work.
Mm-hmm. Would you want to share a little bit about your upcoming writing or your upcoming book? I know we have a little bit of time left. If you want to share a little bit about it.
Yeah. So it's a book on Sylvia Winter right now. Part of the goal is to engage with her large corpus, right? And so she's continually to publish something. I just found out about an interview that came out this morning. You know, she has unpublished articles that are out there. And so she continues to write. And so this is an ever continuous expanding task, it seems like, which is great because I love to read her work. And so when I approached the book originally, my goal was to think about how it is that how coalition looks and coalition building looks through Sylvia Witch's project, thinking about the relationship between particularity and universality. And then in particular, how it is that Indigenous theory relates to Sylvia Witch's project in particular. Because for the most part, she does Caribbean theory, she does critical race theory, in some sense she is thinking about the diaspora, the Black diaspora. And so I had recently read Jody Bird's The Transitive Empire, and I'd read her book, and in her book what she's offering is various kinds of tensions that can exist in within coalition. And so what happens when critical race theory, for instance, reinforces the systems that marginalize Indigenous folks? And then by extension, how can we think about coalition building between Indigenous and Black folks within theory generally? And so that's a really important question for thinking about, you know, the Caribbean, Latin America, you know, North America, you know, just for example. And so that was my original question. How is it that the tools that Jody Bird offers in The Transitive Empire for thinking about that coalitional work, how does that fit in Sylvia Winter's work? And so I started working on it last semester and engaging, you know, more for text and more secondary sources on her as well. And then what I realized is that the question is a lot more complicated than I had intended it, right?
Of
so I needed, yeah, there's no easy or obvious answer. And so I needed to find a way to sort of break it down and engage with it. you know, a lot of it came into thinking about, so what does feminist theory look like for Sylvia Winter, and how does that relate to indigenous theories, indigenous theories of sovereignty? You know, again, not only in the Caribbean, but also in North America as well. How does environmental theory fit into it? Mm. Right. And so, you know, we can talk about Charles Mills has a wonderful essay where he talks about environmental racism. And there are aspects of Sylvia Winter's work that engages with environmental racism. But then that also extends into thinking about indigenous theory as well. You know, Marxism is another great point. And so, what's his name? Glenn Sean Cawthorn. He's an indigenous scholar, and he critiques Marx in some ways because of how Marx talks about a primitive accumulation. And so primitive accumulation is the idea of, you know, the taking of the land, and Marx describes it as violent, right? And so we can talk about, you know, the historical conception of settler colonialism, the first contact of the taking of the land in those ways, of the Trail of Tears, which is part of that as well. But Marx locates that in the past, whereas, you know, that kind of accumulation of land is something that continues to happen right now, right? And so we have all these various ways that settler states are, you know, are appropriating lands from indigenous peoples, are taking land violently, and we have the resistance by indigenous sovereignties, indigenous tribes, indigenous peoples resisting that at the same time. So it's not located in the past, but it's still something that is still relevant today. And so then in that way, like, how is it that Sylvia Winter's engagement with Marxism, and then also thinking about, you know, C.L.R. James, who's text Black Marxism, like, how does it that those fit alongside indigenous theory of Marxism and what's required in order to address, you know, decolonial theory? There's a section on literature, because Dirty Bird has this great chapter where she talks about the figure of Caliban. The figure of Caliban is from The Tempest, and The Tempest is was taken up by a lot of folks as an example of the ways in which settler colonialism was imposed in the Caribbean, right? And so Caliban is a figure of the native from the island who is portrayed very negatively and through a lot of stereotypes. And then there's the Prospero and Miranda, who are the white settlers who, you know, Miranda is the figure of desire, and Prospero is, you know, the master and master of the lands, and also enslaves people within this narrative. And so Sylvia Winter has an essay on The Tempest called Beyond Miranda's Meaning. And so in it, she engages with it critically. And she thinks about, like, what does it mean that Caliban's figured in this way? But also, what does it mean that Caliban's woman is absent from the story? And so then the question becomes, well, how is it that we can approach the figure of Caliban in various ways? Caliban's, you know, is coded as Black or is coded as indigenous. And it's important to recognize when he's coded as indigenous, because if he's not coded as indigenous, then it means the lands aren't occupied at first contact in those ways. And so it's a erasure of indigeneity. And so that's a lot of the book is thinking about, you know, how is it that coalitional politics can avoid the kind of erasure of indigenous sovereignty and indigenous existence writ large in the Caribbean and beyond? And how does Sylvia Winter's work fit into that? It's still very much just started. You know, I feel like I've only begun to sort of, chip into this large project, which feels like it's getting bigger all the time. But I think that I'm optimistic that, you know, I think that Sylvia Winter has offered a lot of tools in her work to engage in these kinds of coalitional projects. And I think that a lot of times she's careful. I mean, she'll note when she's wrong about things, and she'll note when she's learning about certain kinds of things, which is, I think, always really important, because no one enters into the conversation knowing everything, all perspectives. You know, that assumption, I think, is often problematic. And so that there is a learning curve for a lot of us. But I think that there's something particularly helpful or fruitful in what she's giving us in her text throughout the years and even to today as well.
That is so exciting. When you're done with the book, I would love to have you back on the podcast to talk about it. We actually have a historian coming on in a few weeks to talk about environmentalism, masculinity, and I think we're going to touch on a few of those topics. So it's a precursor to that. So I think it's going to be an exciting conversation with her as well. So
awesome. Very cool. And I'd love to. And I think, like, you know, conversations about, you know, environmentalism and masculinity, like, I think that's really interesting and really important that, you know, there's all these different ways to engage with it for sure.
Yeah. I guess one other thing that I just want to mention or highlight is that what we are talking about today certainly applies to psychology and psychoanalysis. And I think something that oftentimes happens in psychology is we are very isolated. I feel like as a field, we are so incredibly isolated, and it is just so delightful to talk with you and to get my ideas going and really think about ways that we can really push the envelope and really start thinking about things a little bit more broadly than what we are. So it's been such a delightful conversation.
Yeah, and same here. And, you know, I think, you know, the feeling of isolation is true for a lot of disciplines. And so I think that it's really important to engage in these interdisciplinary conversations, you know, at all levels. And I think, you know, I have folks who are outside my philosophy discipline, and I value that, and I learn a lot from folks. And that's particularly important also. I mean, right now, a lot of people are isolated because, you know, it is the COVID pandemic is going on, and a lot of us are just sort of, you know, on lockdown in a lot of ways. And it's harder to build that sense of community. But, you know, I think you're right that the siloing is a real thing, and that it's really important to have interdisciplinary conversations for sure. Yeah.
So thank you again for coming on. This has been such a wonderful, delightful conversation, and thank you so much for spending time with us today.
And thank you for having me, and congratulations with your podcast. I think it's wonderful, and you're doing really great work, and it sounds like you're doing really great work, you know, across the university. So congratulations on that for sure. That's good.
Thank you.